the racing season has been, I think, one of the best that we've seen in the last 10 years.
Welcome to the Canadian Cycling Magazine podcast. I'm Matthew Piorro, editor of the magazine and your host. You just heard Michael Berry with his take on the compressed 2020 road season. The season is now in the midst of the closing stages of the Giro d'Italia and the final race, the Vuelta a España. You might recall that Berry and I spoke last June. The UCI had its new compressed road calendar out, and the former pro and I discussed what the racing might be like with the events moved to the late summer and early fall. Now we're nearing the end of racing. When I got back in touch with Berry, I wanted to look back at his predictions. I know there's something unfair about looking back at predictions. In the best of times, guesses about the future are usually wrong. During this pandemic, it's extremely hard to find any certainty. But I still thought the review would be useful. Think about it. You don't know the significance of moves in a race until the race is over. So we wouldn't fully understand the season until the end. We're close to the end now, so let's see what we've learned. I'll tell you one thing. Michael Berry got a pretty significant prediction totally wrong. And, well, we're both glad he did. Michael Berry, how well do you remember some of your predictions? Or do you remember thinking, oh, well, I got that wrong?
I actually didn't even think the season would happen just based on the predictions by the scientists, the epidemiologists, that we were going to go into a second wave. I thought the season might start and then it would come to a grinding halt. I'm happy to say, I think that my predictions were off. Sadly, we have seen some cases come up in races, and now the Giro is being faced with a number of cases, and there is talk of it being stopped early. So we'll just have to see how that goes. There have been a few teams have already pulled out. Paris-Roubaix was canceled. But overall, the season has been really exciting. The racing's been great. We're watching the Giro and Tour of Flanders at the same time, which is pretty fun.
Yeah, that was a bit head-spinning. And I should just mention to listeners, we're recording this on the Giro's rest day, but this is coming out in the midst of the final week, which we hope is still going on as you're listening to this. In June, there was discussions of bubbles. There was talk about race bubbles and team bubbles, and to be honest, I wasn't sure how they're going to work. But we saw them in action at the Tour de France, and I guess the Giro, we might get into that, and recently the Tour of Flanders. There seems to be some differences in either the effectiveness of these bubbles or in their implementation. What do those differences say to you?
I think a lot of it has to do with the cultures, the time of, you know, time in COVID where it's been taking place. There's probably some apathy that develops within both the peloton and the spectators as to their precautions. It's happening all through society now as we enter the second phase of the pandemic. So those are a couple of factors. Also, you know, the cultural differences. Some cultures are a lot better at following rules than other cultures. So you can see that just based in how the seasons have unfolded, I think, and how the spectators are, whether or not they're wearing their masks at the side of the road. I mean, these are, when you have spectators at the side of the road, it's pretty hard to enforce whether or not they're wearing masks and how close they're coming to the riders. What we've seen recently in a lot of races, and Tour of Flanders was remarkable because that's a race where you have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people watching. The roads are just packed with people pretty much throughout the entire race. And this year, there are very few spectators at the roadside. And those spectators who we saw were quite a distance apart. So it was remarkable that they were actually able to implement that during the race and enforce it. So a lot of it, I think, has depended on at every level, from the riders themselves to the staff, to the race organizers, to the spectators, to the government where the race is taking place, how they're enforcing their their precautions or their, you know, as to avoiding COVID and the spread of it. And that's what we're seeing in bike racing right now. And also at the time when the tour was on, we were just entering France and Europe was just entering the second phase of COVID. Whereas now they're getting pretty deep into it already. So you can see those numbers have just like grown exponentially in the last month.
It does seem like the Giro got, and I think they suspected this, organizers suspected this at the Giro, that they got the short end of the stick with in terms of timing, because the tour did, it came online early on in the after things started opening up. And then, as cases mounted, the Tour de France came to a close, and then the Giro just inherits the rising caseload. I wonder how much is also on the organizers and their diligence. At the Giro, there's stories of teams sharing, not only sharing hotels with each other, but also of other guests in hotels, and things are just not kept as rigorous. How much of that falls to the organizer?
It certainly falls to the organizer. I guess in their defense, in a lot of towns, it's hard to find enough hotels, just generally enough housing for an entire race. There would be compromises, but that said, if I was the director of one of those teams and I saw that, I would immediately have the riders isolate themselves. Why would you eat off a buffet if you see other people eating off a buffet? I hope the riders didn't do that. If they were, that's just, you know, stupidity on the team doctor's part and the team manager's part to even let them do it. The riders should know better as well. Like this, there is quite a bit of education around this already. And it's up to the teams and the riders to protect themselves on some level. But that said, ultimately, the organization shouldn't be putting them in those situations. And if they are putting them in that kind of a situation, the team should be aware of it going in, just so they're prepared and they have, you know, their own kitchen and their own chefs and can isolate themselves within the hotels.
How rigorous do you think the Vuelta's COVID protocols will be?
Just based on my experience having ridden the Grand Tours, the Vuelta would be one of the easier races to implement the protocols, just because there are fewer spectators. The Spanish tend to watch the race on television as opposed to going to the roadside. And then also the hotels throughout Spain are quite new. They're fairly big, a lot of them. It's rare that you're in a small hotel. I think, generally speaking, it should be easier for them to implement it. The infrastructure overall is a lot more open in Spain as opposed to in Italy or in France. So you're in fewer small towns. The starts are usually outside of the towns. It should be easier for them to implement all of that. And then also it's under the umbrella of the ASO, and they sounds like they did a pretty good job at the Tour de France of controlling things. The Vuelta organizers have hindsight as well. They can see what went wrong at the Giro and at the Tour de France and the other races and how they can improve on that. So it's in everybody's best interest that these races can go on. Cycling financially really needs it. The riders need to be racing. The season needs to be completed just for financial sustainability. But that said, it shouldn't come at the rest of people's health either.
You mentioned riders taking some initiative in a way, or also being educated in what they should look out for. How much, say, as workers, can riders in the pro peloton advocate for their own safety? How much clout or say do they have?
That's been a problem for years now. I think it became progressively worse through my career, where the rider's voice became weaker and weaker. They didn't have a leader in the peloton who was willing to speak up for everybody. Whereas I think in the 80s and 90s, there were riders like, you know, Bernard Hinault was famous for stepping up and speaking on behalf of all the riders and voicing their opinions about how, you know, just general working conditions. That's eroded over time, and there's very little solidarity amongst the riders. And during my career, a few times we protested in races and we refused to start just because the courses were dangerous. You know, they wanted us to race in snow over mountain passes and that sort of thing. And it was just the not ideal racing conditions. And generally compromises were made and things worked out. But in my last few years that I was racing, so from 2011, 2012, and around that period, there were fewer protests, more crashes. The races were becoming increasingly dangerous. And I think a lot of why there is less solidarity amongst the riders, or why riders are less concerned or less willing to speak up, is just now there isn't a lot of job security in pro cycling. Of course, the top paid riders have security, but many jobs are just interchangeable, and team management can always find, a rider who can do the same job for less money, generally speaking, or that's the rider's fear. So contracts are generally pretty short in the sport, which is a problem. And then also the teams are at the mercy of their sponsors, and the sponsors want to have their names broadcast around the world in the biggest races. So ultimately, no one wants the riders not to be racing, right? So it's a precarious situation, and I think the riders definitely do need to have better representation and need to speak up for their health and safety. It's been apparent, I think, through COVID. You see it in the Giro right now. If there are riders who are feeling uncomfortable with the situation, they're not really going to be willing to speak up, because everybody wants to be racing, because a lot of riders right now need contracts next year, and many teams are looking for sponsors and perhaps could fold at the end of this season. So there'll be many, many riders looking for jobs. You don't want to be the one speaking up and rocking the boat.
I'm going to play you a clip from June. I asked you if the compressed season might throw a dominant team like Ineos Grenadiers off its game. And here's what you said.
Ineos has a massive budget. They have all the majority of the best riders in the peloton. They have a ton of options for pretty much every Grand Tour and race they ride. And they're extremely good at controlling the variables and planning. So it'll be difficult for the other teams to skew that process and their goals, just because they've really figured it out. And they also have the budget to tackle change really quickly and effectively.
Michael, has Ineos been able to control the variables of this season very well by its standards?
I think by their standards, I would say that the season hasn't been as successful as they would have hoped. I mean, if they don't win the Tour de France, then it's usually this, they would consider it somewhat of a failure. They perhaps didn't control the variables as well as they could have, in that their team leaders were not as well prepared for the race due to injuries or just lack of fitness as they should have been by the time the Tour de France came around. And I think they were also faced with the fact that, and Dave Brailsford has said this in interviews, is that the competition has stepped up another level, and the teams are getting themselves ready and training for the races as well as they had been in the past. So the advantages that they would have had in the past have been diminished as the other teams have, risen to another level as well. That said, we're in the last week of the Giro now, and they've done remarkably well, and they did salvage their Tour de France. They've won how many stages in the Giro now? Four or five?
I think it's five, yeah.
Potentially they could have a rider on the podium at the end as well. So and who knows how the Vuelta will go. I would guess that when Brailsford and the management looks at how the season went, they would look at as the maybe not as a complete failure, but they did mismanage it, and they will no doubt take learnings from this year and just work to improve for the coming season and rebuild their team so that they're stronger and they fill those gaps.
In June, we spoke about Peter Sagan and what his season might look like. We knew he was planning to do the Giro, but we weren't sure about the Tour. He's done both. What do you think about that decision?
He's a remarkable rider. I watched his Giro stage win the other day, and it's phenomenal. He's constantly placing second, third, whatever. He's always up there in the bunch sprints. He's extremely consistent. He hasn't won as much as he has in past years, but he's just a phenomenal bike rider. And that stage victory he had the other day was really quite remarkable. And you can see he's not, to do what he did last week after the bulk of racing he had, it seems like he's maintaining his fitness or he's even getting better. So, you know, he didn't win a green jersey, but he was pretty darn close and he's still performing well now. I think based on the season coming to an end fairly soon, probably doing those grand tours, which is, I think, what I said earlier in the year, doing two grand tours back to back will only give him a good bulk of racing and it will help him going into the coming season.
Before this season started, we were hoping Michael Woods would go to the Tour de France once again. He debuted in 2019 there. Instead, he did Tirreno Adriatico. Then he did the World Championships, La Flèche Wallonne, and Liège-Bastogne-Liège. What do you make of his season?
Mike Woods' season has been phenomenal already, especially considering the injury he's coming back from. Returning from a fracture like that is tough, and it seems that he hasn't really lost too much. Maybe, you know, in Tirreno he wasn't as consistent. I don't know, he probably might have been able to win the race in, you know, previous year, I'm not sure. But then in the Ardennes Classics he was riding phenomenally well. He's an extremely good bike rider and he seems to be getting better throughout the season, so, which is normal after an injury like that. With the racing, he'll just keep getting better. The only thing that I would say, having broken numerous bones in the past, is that you do have good days and bad days, and those injuries can plague you sometimes after. So that could be a factor. But overall, it seems like his fitness is really great.
James Piccoli of Montreal is set to race his first Grand Tour with the Vuelta. What could that mean for the rider?
The Vuelta is a great race. It's the best of the three Grand Tours to start out at. It's probably the most manageable. It's the easiest. Easiest in the sense that it's not as intense, in that there's not the same media pressure around the race. The roads are generally wide open, so there's not as much of a fight within the peloton. Overall, it's a good place for a young rider to start.
After many early changes to the women's road calendar, it remained mostly stable. A notable cancellation was, of course, Paris-Roubaix, which was supposed to debut as a women's race this year. What's your sense of how the women's tour went?
From the races that I saw, it was really exciting. The sad thing is the women just don't get the same representation that the men do, but that's building, and hopefully in the coming years, they will have the same number of races and also the same media attention.
What surprised you about the racing during this short season?
Looking back on the last few months of racing this year, one thing that was, I think, surprising, but also made the racing really dynamic and exciting, was the number of young riders who are now at the front of the peloton. There are very few, you know, of the old names from the past. There's like a whole wave of young riders that are on the podiums of the races, winning stages, and those riders, the way that they're racing, they're making for extremely exciting racing as well. They're animating the races. They're attacking. They're racing like kids. You know, it's not as calculated racing, so it's been fun to watch, and I think a lot less predictable than it has been in past years. The Tour de France was a great example of that. The Giro has been a good example. Tour of Flanders the other day was extremely exciting to watch. It was one of the most exciting editions of the race that I've seen. And to see two guys who are such great rivals go into the, Wout van Aert and Mathieu van der Poel, go into the young guys, go into the final kilometers together and sprint against each other was great. And just like this rivalry that they've had through cyclocross and since they were juniors to carry over into the pro ranks in one of the biggest races of the calendar was really neat to see. And so in that sense, like the racing season has been, I think, one of the best that we've seen in the last 10 years.
What are your thoughts on this seemingly younger shift in the riders? Like you mentioned, we have Wout van Aert and Mathieu van der Poel, who are in their mid-20s, and they're already a major force. And then we have Tadej Pogacar, who just won the Tour de France. What is with this seeming trend of younger riders performing at all the big races? Is that a change in training? Is that a change in culture? Is it a change in who's calling the shots?
I think there are probably many variables involved in why the young riders have, and we're talking young riders, a lot of these guys are under 25 years old, which is rare in cycling to have, you know, riders who are so young performing at the biggest races so consistently throughout the season. And it's one thing that's interesting is many of them have come from other sports or, you know, other disciplines within cycling. You have guys who have raced mountain bike, cyclocross. Evenepoel was junior world champion and came into the sport like really quite late and then immediately was performing at the highest level. So I think probably a lot of it is just, first, there's a structure within the teams where like teams in the past have been apprehensive to let young riders even race the biggest races right off the bat unless they're extremely good. That's changed a little bit. So, you know, there's a change in culture probably where team management is seen through power numbers or through data or just through a knowledge shift that, yeah, young riders can perform at in 6-7 hour races just as good as 32-year-old riders can. And then I think generally speaking, there is like a shift in generation every 10 years or so where a whole bunch of guys will retire and younger guys will come in and fill that gap. So that probably happened as well. Like I stopped racing in 2012 and there are very few guys in the peloton left who I raced with. Things change quite quickly. But I think it's been really great to see a lot of young guys and also they race with panache, as the French say. So they're not scared to attack and go from a long way out, just animate the races.
Looking back on this season, where we're at right now, what do you think worked really well this season that you hope to see next season, whether that's a really short season or a longer season in 2021?
I actually think from a spectator's perspective, a compressed season worked really well because you had nonstop racing. I would imagine it was probably quite hard on the teams and, you know, the management and even the riders. But from a spectator's perspective, it was pretty exciting. But that was probably also because we were waiting. You know, we had whatever it was, four or five months without any racing at all. So I'm sure we were all eager to watch a lot of bike racing.
One of cycling's problems, people argue, or some people have argued, is that it lacks, you know, a coherent storyline. You know, you have the classics, you have the tour, and it's like, well, what does one have to do with the other? And, you know, for someone who's not spent a lot of time with cycling, it doesn't always make a lot of sense.
Yeah. So I agree with what you're saying. And one thing where that was really noticeable this year was we went from Strade Bianche, Milan San Remo, and the Dauphiné to the, you know, all these stage races, followed by the Tour de France, followed by the World Championships. And then you have a couple more classics in the Giro. When you look at that from a spectator's perspective, you see the same names performing in all the races. So it's a lot better way of developing the stars of the sport. Whereas in past years, it's been quite segregated where you have the classics riders and then you have the tour riders and then the world championships is kind of at the end of the season. You don't see the guys who have performed in the tour necessarily even racing the world championships. So this year it was great. Like, you know, shortly after the Tour de France finish, you have the Tour de France champion animating the finale of the world championships, which is really how it should be. And then all the guys who have, you know, performed extremely well in the Tour de France are on the podium or in the top 10 of the World Championships, when really that's how a season should be structured. And that's how it was, I think, they changed in 1996. So 1995 was probably the last time the Worlds were, after the Tour de France in the summer. And then they shifted things. Structuring the season a little more like that would make sense. But there are also far fewer races this year than there have been in past years. So obviously you can't compress it as much as we have this year. But just taking a few of the lessons from from the way the season has flowed this year, I think it would be beneficial to pro cycling and just marketing it better and putting the real champions in the races throughout the season.
Well, Michael, I thank you for your analysis, and I don't know, we'll have to talk again when we find out what's happening in 2021.
Yes. Yeah, I look forward to it.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.
And that's the episode. It's written and edited by me, Matthew Piaro. I had help from web editors Rob Sterney, Terry McCall, and Lily Hansen-Gillis. The podcast is produced by Adam Killick. He composed the music, too. Thanks to Ontario Creates for its support. And thank you for listening. Please rate and review the show. Do enjoy the rest of the season's road racing, ride safely, and I'll talk to you later.